I'm Isa Ali. Brits of Iranian heritage. In recent years, British-Iranian tensions have risen to great levels. The media portrayal of Iran in the media tends to be negative, with Iran regularly accused of extremism. Iranians, meanwhile, view the British as an imperial power who's determined to impose their domination over the country once again. I decided to try to get to the bottom of this relationship between the two countries by speaking to the leading academics and experts in order that I may not be influenced by the sensationalism of the mainstream media. It's important in any discussion to look back into the history in order to gain an understanding of the modern day relationship. Having learned more about the relationship between Iran and Britain during the Qajar period, it became clear to me that a number of British policies had created a feeling of resentment towards the British. The level of resistance within the country in the face of this colonization grew and became more widespread.
In 1809, during the first war between Iran and Russia, another agreement was signed between Iran and England. The deal was that if Iran cut ties with all European countries, in return, England would provide the Iranian government with military and financial support if Iran was attacked by a foreign country. When Iran needed England's help, the Napoleonic threat forced England to split with Russia to save Europe.
The Persians' belief that the British would assist Persia in the event of an invasion by another force, which was specifically Russia. Of course, when they started off with the wars in the Caucasus, the British didn't do anything about it because by then they were allies with the Russians against the French. So really, this started right at the beginning of the 19th century, right in the early years of the Qajar period, and because of the Napoleonic Wars in Europe.
A year after the Treaty of Golestan, a new British ambassador, Sir Henry Ellis, was sent to Tehran. Sir Gore Ouseley, a British diplomat, was pivotal to the drawing up of the Treaty of Golestan, which defined the borders between Russia and Iran.
I've come to the British Museum to have a look at some of the Qajar artifacts from 18th century Iran. I'm also here to meet Dr. Reza Rezai, who will talk me through some of these artifacts.
Golestan Treaty was on 1813. Which Iran lost 17 cities in Caucasus, including Azerbaijan, including, say, the Dagestan, and Armenia, Georgia, it lost to Russia. And they forcefully had signed to the Golestan Treaty, and Britain were involved in the treaty with Russia and Golestan Treaty.
Later in the Qajar period, Karim Khan Zand increased the level of foreign trade between Iran and Britain through the Persian Gulf port of Basra.
We had some sort of, again, deal with the Britain during the Karim Khan Zand, Zand dynasty, whom again was concerning about the Persian Gulf area, which was a place for trade between the, say that Britain in 1763. Whom they got a concession and access to India on the East Indian Company. And then it gone further. They used to use the port of the Persian Gulf as a say that they trade there to do some sort of export-import. And Iranian were using as a free, duty-free, business with Britain on the basis of they give them also access to the Persian Gulf ports they were using constantly.
One of the most important reasons for being active in the negotiations was because Britain, Iran, and the Turkish Ottoman state were desperate to avoid war with each other. The British Foreign Office view was that it feared that the continued clash between Iran and the Ottoman state would destabilize the Middle East and as a result destabilize Britain's route to India. Thus, Britain managed to negotiate peace between Iran and Turkey and secured their routes to the east. Was the Anglo-Persian crisis regarding Herat?
After the date you mentioned, after the 1630s, there was a peace treaty about 1638, which really ended all the Ottoman-Safavid hostilities. I mean, after that, the last century of the Safavid period, the 18th century, 17th century, was peaceful. And although there were various opportunities and there were various provocations even, in fact, there were no more wars after the Iranians lost Baghdad again fairly quickly under Sultan Murad, I think, then that was really it. So it was clear that the effort to coordinate had really failed.
And it was then Britain came forward. He made another treaty after the Golestan Treaty in 1814. In that treaty, he mentioned that, for example, if Iran goes to the war with Afghans, we remain neutral.
After the death of Nadir Shah of Iran, Iranian efforts to dominate Herat brought them into direct conflict with the English. But for the Iranians, Herat was a natural part of their nation and an integral part of their territory.
Muhammad Shah, which was a son of Abbas Mirza, came in power. He campaigned against the Herat, and he sieged the Iraq. Britain declared war and ignored the 1814 treaty. He declared war on Iran. He said that as long as you do not give up your siege on Herat, we are going to invade Kharg Island in Persian Gulf.
I mean, this was an interesting case because in this period, I mean, there was more than one period where the Iranians wished, the Qajar government wished to try to restore Iranian authority over Herat. The Qajar's territorial ambitions were essentially to re-establish the state as far as the boundaries of the old Safavid Empire, and this was something which was, you know, a goal that they set out to achieve with the founder of the dynasty, Aga Muhammad Khan, and, you know, didn't quite achieve it, but actually got quite a long way towards restoring Iran's territorial extent to where it had been under the Safavid.
As mentioned previously, one of the big problems between Britain and Iran at the time was the conflict over Herat in modern-day Afghanistan. It became clear to me that within Afghanistan, Britain had certain strategic objectives, one of which was to contain Iran and weaken it when necessary by placing a puppet monarchy in Afghanistan. Ultimately, this was aimed to get through Iran and Afghanistan in order to reach the main prize, India.
So when it came to a question of who should control Herat, the British were much happier to see the Afghans ruling Herat than to see the Iranians ruling Herat.
In November 1814, the people of Afghanistan started fighting against the British. This uprising led to the death of an important British political figure called Alexander Burnes. When the rural people of Afghanistan entered the war against the British, the response of the British completely underestimated their resistance. The commander of the British army tried to resolve the situation. Although when he couldn't quell the uprising, a massacre took place with troops moving from Kabul to Jalalabad. After the British evacuated from Afghanistan, Yar Muhammad Khan was installed as a puppet ruler over Herat.
The border that certainly the Herat War contributed to making was something that has been mirrored in various other border drawings around the entire Middle East, of course, but particularly around Iran. And the border between the Ottomans and the Persians, the Qajars, was also a very, very difficult border to draw. And there were various times when there were border groups, diplomatic representatives from Russia and the Ottomans and Persia and the English that were extremely involved with this. So the very contours of the territories were very much determined partially by the British Empire, and that, of course, also contributed to the relationship.
The British government portrayed Nasruddin Shah's administration as having limited powers in all parts of the country and unable to develop a revolt against British control. At this point, the British were aiming to reduce the legitimacy of the Qajar dynasty in order to be able to remove them from power. The Paris Peace Treaty, which was dealing with the issue of Herat, was brokered by Britain, France, and Russia after the war with Iran and Britain had finished. In November 1856, Farrukh Shah Khan went to the Ottoman court, where British agents were having a meeting with the Turkish ministers. He came with the intention of asking for peace. Lord Stanford, the British ambassador, demanded a peace treaty for the evacuation of Herat and a formal commitment from Iran not to interfere in the affairs of the state. When Farouk Khan sent this proposal to Tehran, he went back to the Ottoman court and urged them to mediate on their behalf with the British. Farouk Khan then decided to head to France, after deciding that he wouldn't accept the requests of the British. After Napoleon's accession to the throne of France, his attention was soon set on Iran and his wish to establish close relations with the Iranian Shah. Napoleon provided mediation between Farouk Khan and Britain.
After Napoleon III became King of France, the country became interested in Iran, and so Napoleon sent an ambassador there called Prosper Bourg. He made friendly ties with Nasiruddin Shah, who welcomed him. On the 25th of January 1857, Napoleon III summoned Farrukh Khan, and with his mediation, peace talks between Farrukh Khan and Lord Cavelli, the British ambassador, began.
On March 4, 1857, a treaty was signed between Farrukh Khan and Lord Cavelli, whereby the Iranian government promised not to interfere in Herat and Afghanistan and removed all troops from those territories. However, Britain didn't keep to their side of the treaty and supported Afghan fighters who attacked and killed members of the Iranian army.
Interestingly also, though, a lot of our negotiations, I say the British negotiations, were through the government in India. It wasn't actually the Foreign Office in Whitehall. It was the Indian government was really the concerned party. And in fact, this was one of the problems with British foreign policy, whether it was driven by India or by London at different periods. But it was short, but there was a battle. I mean, the British landed again in the Persian Gulf, and they marched up into the southern, into Fars province, and there was a battle at a place called Khushab. And the Persians lost, unfortunately, and that was that. And so they were brought to the negotiating table again, and there was the treaty, which sort of forbade them, really, to make any further efforts on Herat.
And it became interesting to note during my research the character of Amir Kabir, a prime minister of great significance during the Qajar period.
The English minister's wife, Mrs. Shale, had tried to portray as insignificant Amir Kabir's actions by using ironic statements. But in some cases, she was forced to tell the truth. She brings in her book that Amir Kabir was an outstanding man in many ways. One of Amir Kabir's great hopes was to promote Iranian officials in the international community and to liberate his country from what he believed to be the shackles of the three powerful neighboring countries.
Another, for example, concession he made with Reuters, and these also have been again gone outcry of the say that Iranian and so on that have been cancelled. That was a that sort of say that defeat for the court for the Shah of Iran was a beginning of the end of Qajar dynasty.
The Reuters concession was an extraordinary concession, even in the age of empire, in that it was, I mean, I don't remember the precise percentage, but it was a concession which covered exploitation of Iran's mineral and many other resources over a huge proportion of the territory of Iran. So, you know, it was even in an era when European entrepreneurs were in the habit of gaining very comprehensive or very large concessions on terms that by today's standards look quite extraordinarily favourable to the capitalist and unfavourable to the host country. This was an extraordinary concession.
On the Qajar King's first trip to Europe in 1873 to St. Petersburg, Russia, the King protested to the Russian Prime Minister and the Russian Prince due to their interference in Iranian affairs. During the Qajar period, many concessions were granted to British businessmen, giving them the right to develop certain parts of the Iranian economy.
So if you look at the debate on the British side about this concession, it's by no means the case that Reuters was satisfied with the support that he got from British officialdom. And it's by no means the case that British officialdom was keen to encourage and support every British commercial venture in Iran. Of course, usually those British entrepreneurs had their lobbyists, you know, people in Parliament, people, you know, in the newspapers perhaps, who were seeking to influence policy. But it would not be true to suggest that British government policy at that time was one which universally was supportive of British capital.
However, it soon became clear that these concessions weren't aimed at developing Iran's economy, but at exploiting it.
Because, you know, we often talk about trade and the flag and the relationship between them, and, you know, it's as true in today's world as it was in the 19th century. There's no doubt that British entrepreneurs and capitalists took advantage of British political and military power to advance their interests. There's no doubt that when Britain was negotiating treaties and agreements with the Iranian government, they sought concessions from British merchants, which in many ways gave them a privileged position vis-a-vis Iran's own merchants.
One of these concessions was for the Imperial Bank of Persia, which was given to Baron de Ruyter, the same de Ruyter who had been given the Ruyter's concession almost 10 years previously, which had raised such outcry amongst Iranians that it had to be reversed. The Imperial Bank of Persia was responsible for printing all of Iran's currency, giving Britain an unrivaled control over the Iranian economy from thousands of miles away.
I would certainly agree that there were, I mean, the Imperial Bank of Persia certainly was something which the British government saw as being in its interest. So I would make a clear distinction between that and Reuters' other very wide-ranging concession, which, you know, I think quite rightly the British, you know, in Tehran and some of those who were looking at Iran with an expert perspective simply saw as being something that was not going to be successful. It was too much to ask for. So, you know, they were, in some ways, perhaps they had a better awareness of the realities of Iranian politics and what was feasible and what wasn't. The Imperial Bank of Persia, I would say, is really a different case.
Nasiruddin Shah assigned the shipping points in the South Karun River to the Lynch Brothers Company in 1888. The English were fully engaged in fields such as road construction and communications in Iran, all in order to dominate and compete with the Russians. What the British made was an attempt to prevent the Russians from reaching the Persian Gulf through the Qajari government and also be able to maintain its influence in southern Iran. With regards to telegraph lines, the British took advantage of Nasiruddin's tendency towards European civilization. When the British, in an agreement with the Ottomans, installed telegraph lines between the Red Sea and Baghdad, Nasiruddin Shah became eager to follow suit. Finally, in 1870, the British set up telegraph lines in Bushehr and Bandar Abbas that connected Europe and India to Iran. Telegraph lines were also established inside Iran again by the British. And so for a long time, Iran's telegraph office was in the hands of the British.
Sir Dennis Wright speaks about the importance of telegraph lines in Iran for Britain. From the mid-1860s to the end of the Qajar period in Iran, the British telegraph house was the most valuable asset in regards to India and Europe. These telegraph wires managed to connect the east and the west sides of the British Empire.
The dispute between Iran and England over Bahrain has always been an open wound. From the distant past, Bahrain belonged to Iran. Under a contract, Bahrain officially came under British rule.
Until 1873, Bahrain was seen as a part of Iranian territory. It was after this point that bloody clashes took place, whereby rebels supported by the British succeeded and took away Bahrain from the part of Iranian territory. Britain had considerable influence in the Persian Gulf region during the 1800s, whereby it made agreements with local sheikhs in the peninsula to hand control over to them and to thus weaken Iranian control over these islands and kingdoms. One of these families is the Al-Khalifa family in Bahrain, who have ruled the island for almost 200 years.
We're now on our way to interview Dr. Stephanie Cronin, who's also an academic at the University of Oxford, and who actually travels regularly to Iran in order to conduct her research on the Qajar period. So hopefully we'll be able to get even more of an in-depth understanding of Britain's colonial role during the Qajar period. To begin my journey, I've come to Oxford, home of the world-famous University of Oxford, to speak to some of their most foremost academics.
Now, for Iran, has always seen the Persian Gulf as, as an Iranian lake, as a Persian lake. So I think this is the origin of Iran's claim to Bahrain. Again, this can be contrasted with the British, who really saw themselves as the Persian Gulf power par excellence. They saw themselves as a Persian Gulf power. They wanted to defend the local rulers who accepted their protection, and they wanted to exclude other imperial powers from the Gulf region.
By the 1850s, Britain was given permission to dock their fleet in Bahrain. In 1861, a formal agreement was made between Britain and the Bahraini sheikhs, giving them total support in return for British military control.
The dispute between Iran and Britain over Bahrain has always been an open wound. From the distant past, Bahrain belonged to Iran. Under a contract, Bahrain officially came under British rule. In 1870, Britain ousted Sheikh Mohammed, who had pro-Iranian tendencies, and replaced him with Sheikh Issa, who was one of England's supporters. The British later forced Sheikh Issa to stop communicating with other countries, unless with permission by the British government. Besides, no other state was able to have a political representative in Bahrain except the British.
The other thing which I think changes quite significantly as the century progresses is that, and this is really an independent development, is that British businesses and British capitalists and entrepreneurs again, you know, simply extend their network, extend their interests, and are looking for new markets, new opportunities. And Iran comes onto the horizon for them in a way that it hadn't, you know, for pretty well two centuries, or best part of two centuries since the Safavid period.
In 1739, Nader Shah took Baluchistan and assigned Nasir Khan Barahui to rule it. After the assassination of Nader Shah, Nasir Khan Durrani obeyed Ahmad Shah. But after a while, he declared his independence and ruled that region for a long time. With the death of Nasir Khan in 1795, there was a long dispute among Baluchi tribal chiefs in Baluchistan. At the time of Muhammad Shah, Iran's government succeeded to take back Baluchistan. But when England seized the huge desert located in southwestern India, which came to be known as England's Baluchistan, England became Iran's neighbor. And then they started to think about determining border lines.
In 1864, Frederick Goldsmith was tasked with drawing the Iranian borders in the modern-day region known as Sistan-Baluchistan. Goldsmith had drawn up the boundaries in such a way as to divide the region, ensuring British imperial interests were served for centuries to come.
So the question of border delimitation is very sensitive and difficult for Iran, I think. But it's something that Britain and Russia insist upon because for them it's a natural state of affairs. The countries have borders which are clearly delimited and people understand on which side of the borders they're located. This gives them an allegiance to the central authority. So I think it was much more important for the British and the Russians than it was for the Iranians. And through the 19th century, you see this process being imposed on Iran, really, by the British and the Russians in various combinations. And through it, Iran does suffer. It suffers territorially, because if you look at Iran at the end of the 19th century, it's much smaller than at least Iranians thought it was at the beginning of the 19th century.
After Baluchistan's borders were determined, the British government announced that they wanted Sistan's arbitration. Nasiruddin Shah and Shir Ali, the King of Afghanistan, agreed with this proposal, and General Goldsmith was appointed as ruler. In 1872, Goldsmith divided Sistan into two parts, the main part and an external part. The main Sistan in the west part of Hirmand River, with an area of 1,500 square kilometers and a population of 45,000, was given to Iran. And the external Sistan in the east part of Hirmand River was given to Afghanistan.
Both in the west and in the east, there were boundary commissions, they were called. Of course, a lot of negotiation, and especially the Sistan Boundary Commission, and the Afghan Boundary Commission, which essentially is going right down the east borders of Iran, which also had to reflect losses because of the advance of Russians into Central Asia, because Iran lost quite a bit of territory up in the northeast to the Russians as well. There was a Sir Frederick Goldsmith led a mission in the 1860s, a border commission, and they had to negotiate.
As a result, Goldsmith's mission was not to judge on disputes over the Balochistan border, but to enforce the detailed plans of Balochistan's borders, which had been appointed to him in 1870. Here, it's noteworthy to point to the irresponsible attitude of Qajari rulers, especially Nasser al-Din Shah, towards the issue of territorial integrity. All attempts made by the British were nothing but a political and geographic game.